The music is the sound of the early 20s. The title of the song is Whispering. There was another whispering in the early 20s, a whispering that was soon to become a voice of a great university and the voice of a budding new industry. On April 4th in 1922, the whisper, which was to become the voice of Purdue University, was first heard. The whisper was WBAA, Indiana's first broadcasting station. For this special program, we brought together sounds and voices, facts and figures, records and recollections, in the hope that we can tell, in part, the story of WBAA. No one program can tell the story. Not even a series of programs or a book can really tell the story. The real story is in the minds of those who lived it. Experiments in radio communications at Purdue began many years before the official birthday of WBAA. In 1910, students in the School of Electrical Engineering attempted to install a wireless station at Purdue. During these early years, funds were limited, and all work had to be done with homemade or donated equipment. In 1919, the government granted the university a license to operate a wireless station with the call letters 9YB. 9YB operated until April 4 of 1922, when WBAA was licensed to broadcast on 834 kilocycles with 20 watts of power during specified hours. The original studios were located in the basement of the old EE building. Tom Johnston, Director of Information here at Purdue University, has been associated with WBAA since its earliest days.
Well, my first contact with WBAA was when we started operations back in April of 1922. I was asked by Professor R.V. Ockitz, who had the original idea for the station. Ockitz was professor of electrical engineering and was interested in radio. He taught the courses in communications, and radio hadn't come into being yet as an agency like as it is today. It was just barely starting. We had to use headphones. In the days of headphones, many folks, particularly older people, remember the days they had to search around with little crystal sets, trying to find this station or that station on the air. This was the first station in Indiana, and Ockitz started it. Ockitz, by the way, lives at Aurora, Indiana, was president of the telephone company down there for some years. He resigned in the early 30s and went to Aurora as president of the telephone company, and he retired from those duties in the last two or three years. But he's still very active, keenly interested in things that are going on. Well, he started the station, had the idea as a means of communication with the people of the state. I had developed the informational service, relations only to agriculture first, and then the whole university, to tell the story of Purdue, to interpret the work being done by Purdue to the people of the state. And he had the idea of why not use radio. So he started the station in the basement of what was formerly the Electrical Engineering Building. It stood... It was built in 1889 and stood where the present chemistry building now stands on the campus at Purdue. He had a little room there, about 12 by 14 feet, and had a little transmitter. 250 watts was the power, and instituted programs Monday night and Friday night. Those were the only times during the week that were on the air. One-half-hour programs devoted to agriculture. Some of the larger stations over the country had been started before that time, and their first attempt was to reach, be of service to the field of agriculture. So Ockitz had that say, although an electrical engineering prof, he had the idea of making it of service to the farmers of Indiana. That was my first attempt to broadcast, tell the story of Purdue, something new and unusual, in the field of agriculture. We did not attempt to get into the general field of broadcasting for two or three years, only two nights a week, as I said, Monday and Friday. We advertised that through the press and over the broadcasts themselves. Folks were fishing around in the air at that time with those crystal sets trying to get this station, KA, WBA. I remember one lady said to me that she got Purdue Station, was quite thrilled to get it. She said she refused to get a set, however, for probably 4 or 5 years, a farm wife, Professor B.H. Duddleson. She said, if I had known this music and the programs I hear from KDKA and WGN, other station in Chicago, KDKA at Pittsburgh, other stations had been floating, this music had been floating around over our barn lot, I'd have bought this set when it first started. It took a while to convince me that it was worthwhile. Well, WBA has grown from that those two nights program, two nights once a week, each week, to a station where we're on the air 15 hours a day, 6 days a week. You know the story from there on.
Weren't you at one time manager?
Yes, I was chairman of the radio committee, which had charge of the operation of the station. I headed the committee for about 15, maybe 18 years, and starting about a year or so before World War II. And C. Francis Harding, was the head of the School of Electrical Engineering in those days, and he was chairman of the committee. Dean Knapp, Associate Dean of Engineering, is a member of the committee, and he served as chairman for a year or two. And I happened to be away from one of the committee meetings for the operations of the station, so they elected me chairman. And I headed the committee all those years, being responsible for the format of the programs, for the budget, and the general station operation. That was left in the hands of a committee in those days, and operated on that basis for some 15, 18 years from the time the station started. I was on the committee originally for the start of the station. L.E. Hoffman was on early in the time. Hoffman was assistant county agent leader in those days, and another member of the committee, I've forgotten who the others were, but I remember those, the four of us, Harding, Knapp, Hoffman, and myself, were among the four original persons who take part in this program and take part in the plans for the station.
How did the public feel generally about radio at that time, say in the early 20s?
The public was only fairly interested, not greatly interested, but they were interested in radio, but they weren't particularly interested in WBAA until we found this, that they found this, I should say, that we were interested only in service to the people of the state. I wrote the station a statement of policy for the station, establishing daily contact with the farm people of Indiana primarily and with the general public at large, a point of contact of the liaison between the university and the people of the state. And Dr. Elliott approved that. He was then the president of the university, gave it his blessing, and said that's the basis on which we'll operate, of service to the people of Indiana. And at that time, after we'd been going some 10 or 15 years, we had two or three offers to buy the station. Men came down from Chicago and wanted to buy the station and make it a commercial station. But three or four of us held out for a sustaining station, free of advertising, existing only for this public service, the way we have always regarded the operation of WBAA. In all of the programs that we have built, and that have been developed over the years, all of them have been built and planned with the idea of serving the people of Indiana better than we've ever served them before. And this is a day-to-day contact. We've got it yet as a day-to-day contact with the people of Indiana and for the benefit of the people of Indiana. That's really the basic idea about this station. I'm one of those who's held out always to maintain it as an educational station without accepting advertising to compete with other stations, and as one of service to the people of the state.
On July 8, 1924, WBAA made the first of a number of frequency changes, moving to 1060 kilocycles. On January 15, 1925, the frequency changed to 1100 kilocycles, and the power was increased to 500 watts. In April of 1927, the studios were moved from the basement to the first floor of the old EE building. The single studio was acoustically treated with burlap to reduce sound reflections,
We laugh at this, perhaps, but the same principle is used in all studios today. In June 1927, WBAA was ordered to share the 1100 kilocycle frequency with another station, and in November of 1928, WBAA's frequency was again changed to 1400 kilocycles and shared with WCMA, Culver, Indiana, and WKBF, now WIRE, in Indianapolis. Also at this time, the station location was moved to the third floor of the new EE building. Well, during these confusing times, we did have listeners, and we want you to meet some of them now. First, here is the Reverend Louis C. Westenbarger of Rural Route 9 of Lafayette.
Well, it was in the during the winter of 1921-22, sometime in early 22, we were sitting over at the dormitory at the Widener Institute. That was a junior college at Mulberry, Indiana. And that's just 10 miles from Lafayette. And I remember Mr. William Downey, who was a caretaker there at the school, had a radio outfit in his apartment. And the students would go in there, and he had two sets of earphones. And we would, maybe four of us, each of us take one earphone and listen to what was coming over. And I remember that one of the stations that he had on quite frequently was the Lafayette station.
Do you remember, by any chance, our first broadcast as WBAA? This was in 1922.
No, I don't think I recall the actual first broadcast, but in the first days of your broadcasting, I'm sure we heard... I know one time we students tried an experiment. We took a mixing bowl and laid the receivers down in the mixing bowl, and then a whole bunch of us got around the mixing bowl and listened. I remember at that time there was band music coming from the Purdue station.
They tried that with pots and pans too.
Mm-hmm.
That same thing. It doesn't help too much.
And I remember one student, a student in the physics class there, he said that the time would come when it would come out of a horn and everybody would hear it all over the room. And I couldn't understand how that could ever be possible.
What was the general public reaction to radio in those days? Was it a toy, or did they think anything worthwhile would come from it?
Well, I think the people around Mulberry in those days thought it was more or less of a novelty and probably soon wear off. Didn't take it too seriously at that time. But the boys in the dorm were messing around with crystal sets and making a little bit of experiments with those. And I know the professor in our physics class, I was taking physics at that school, and I remember he was quite thrilled about it and quite excited about it.
Another listener was, and still is, Mrs. O.L. McKay of Romney.
Well, it must have been soon after it went on the air. I can't remember just exactly, but I know we were all excited about it when we knew Purdue was going to have a radio station. And as soon as we had our radio, which was, I'm sure, not too long after, well, of course, we always waited and listened for the programs which came from Purdue. And, of course, these days... It's such a, if I might add this in here, it's such a pleasure to listen to Purdue because you hear a program instead of all the advertisement that you hear on all of the other stations.
This is what we want you to add.
Well, do you? Well, good. But there's so many things when we get the program and look it over, if you could have time to listen to all of the things that you wish you could, there's such a wealth of wonderful information.
What did people think of radio in those days?
Well, if the people who came to our house to listen night after night after night when we first got ours is any indication, well, everyone was really very excited about it. And, of course, then more people began getting them. And the special stations, of course, that we could hear then, not besides Purdue, were KDKA at Pittsburgh and KYW in Chicago. And then, of course, the station over which the Kansas City Nighthawks came from 12 until 2 in the morning. I can't remember the call letters now from that station. But
did you stay up for that one?
Well, I did sometimes, but finally I stayed up so many times I couldn't stay awake. But our friends came in night after night and stayed up because that was really the grand finale of a nice radio evening if they could listen to all the Kansas City Nighthawk program.
You've been on Purdue Station, WBAA, at several times, you've told me, with the home demonstration chorus. This might be something interesting to our listeners.
Well, would you like to know that WBAA is directly responsible for the starting of the home demonstration, Tippecanoe County Home Demonstration Chorus? At that time, it was called the Tippecanoe County Home Economics Chorus because the clubs were called home economics clubs. It was when Mr. Pershing, who was then the county agent, I'm not saying that in a very good way, at that time the county extension office was responsible for one program a month on Friday evening always, I think. And this one time, Mr. Pershing, who is a great lover of music of all kinds, all good music, had suggested that members of the Comec clubs from around the county come in and practice for a little while and then sing on this program. And that's what we did. We had such a good time doing that first evening that many of us asked Mr. Stewart, who had been asked to direct the chorus rather in a hurry, if we could get together sometimes just to sing. We had enjoyed it so much. And the outcome was the Tippecanoe County Chorus, which has been, as you know, leader in county choruses in the state of Indiana. And it wasn't too long after that, and I can't remember just what year, but Miss Lilla Gaddis, who was then state leader of home demonstration agents, was very much interested in it, and it became then an extension project with Mr. Stewart at the head of it.
And that's statewide now?
Statewide, and as I understand, over the years, there have been a good many inquiries from other states about our chorus set up in this state. And there is a chorus festival each year. It used to be in the wintertime during the January conference, but of course there was always roads to contend with then if the weather were bad, so now it's during the summer, which is a much better time.
You missed a program once, or you were late to a program.
Oh, that was one of the programs which the county agent's office was putting on, and I expect that was the year I was a state president of the clubs, I'm not sure, but I was supposed to announce the program. And on the way in to town, we were held up a long time by a freight train as we went into Lafayette, and the program had started, and Mr. Pershing had to pinch hit, and my folks who were at home listening for me to begin the program were wondering what had happened to us, whether we had had trouble or not, but then finally we were able to get there. It was quite interesting. There's been several times when I've had occasion to be on the station, and it's always been just a great privilege to have anything to do with it.
Do you still listen to the station?
Oh, yes, I should say I do listen. I don't always have time to listen to as many things and follow up. Not 2 or 3 years ago, or whenever it was, I took the course of German lessons that were given over the station. I had taken German 4 years of it in school quite a long time ago, and it was a lot of fun to take those lessons again, to follow them, and sort of think back through it a little bit. Did you ever see one of the real old first Atwater Kent radios?
I never have. I've heard of them.
Well, that's what ours was. It was on a long board, I would say nearly a yard long, and it had three dials, and all of the tubes were exposed. And you had to be able to tune that by tuning all three dials. You had to be able to get each one set just right in order to get anything. And, of course, at first, there were only earphones. Well, our experience was that we had a lot of friends who wanted to hear the radio, and we were awfully glad to share it. It was a pleasure. But there were some who would put the earphones on and keep them so long when others were just almost prancing around waiting for their turn. And of course, it seemed a little bit selfish, but they were just really glued to the...
Well, this was before the advent of loudspeakers.
That's right. And then when the loudspeaker first came, the first one that we had, and I expect it was everybody had the same experience, looked like the... almost like the horn that went with the...
The Victrola.
Years ago. And then it wasn't very long after that till a more modern one and a much better one came, a better... And that, of course, added a lot because so many people could really appreciate and hear radio a lot better. And then one of the first things that we noticed, we were so impressed by this, that when President Wilson was very sick and the bulletins began to come. Now, that's the first time that I remember hearing things of that sort. And I believe it's about the first time that those things went on the air. Now we're very used to bulletins being given. Any time they happen, things happen. But that time, that was quite an experience to hear those things coming over.
WBAA was off the air for a time in 1922 after a fire that year completely destroyed the studio and the equipment. Under the supervision of J.W. Stafford, then manager, the station was reconstructed in the summer of 1929 by P.C. Sandretto and R.C. Bierman. The new station was licensed on January 25, 1930, to operate on the same basis as before. I would like to read a portion of a letter the station received from Mr. P.C. Sandretto just recently. Mr. Sandretto says, I came to Purdue after having attended another school and was somewhere between a sophomore and a junior. The year was 1927, and to say that the equipment was rudimentary would have been an understatement. The transmitter consisted of 2 1-quarter tubes in parallel, modulated by 2 more. The equipment was homemade and was apparently the outgrowth of some amateur activities. The entire assembly was mounted on slate panels and housed in a small cubbyhole next to the studio, which was no larger than 15 by 15 feet. The entire operation was conducted by the Electrical Engineering School under the supervision of J.W. Stafford, electrical engineering instructor. The chief engineers were Walter Lanterman and George Metcalf. The announcing and program directing were also in the hands of EE students. The arrangements were highly informal, and as I recall, programs were put on 3 nights a week in addition to the announcement of Indianapolis farm statistics. In 1927, the chief announcer was P.V. Tierney. The chief requirement of the program director was that he have a source of immediate programs. This programming usually consisted of asking a fraternity brother to play the piano in event that the members who were supposed to be on the program failed to appear. I forgot to mention that the sole content of the studio was 1 microphone and a very beaten-up piano. The remainder of the furnishings consisted of chairs and so forth, borrowed from the EE department. Metcalf and Lanterman graduated in June of 1928, and in September of that year, I was appointed by Professor Harding, head of the School of EE, as chief engineer. Sometime in the late fall of 1928 or early spring of 1929, a fire started in the station at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Metcalf and Lanterman had constructed an amplifier mounted entirely on wooden panels, which were painted with black enamel. This amplifier was operated from a huge bank of dry cells. Apparently, the fire started in the amplifier battery arrangement and set fire to the Celotex wall, and the result was a shambles. Even the slate panels disintegrated. The aluminum condensers melted, and fortunately, the building construction must have been very excellent fireproof nature, as the fire was confined to the station and the studio. Most of the staff were at classes in the building at the time and arrived to inspect the ruins. In fact, one of them discovered the fire. We were all pretty blue about it when someone noticed that the piano had been destroyed. At that discovery, all hands let out a loud cheer. Something good had happened from that fire. I do not know why it was decided that the new station should be built by us, but the probable cause of this decision was the necessity to operate on a very limited budget. I suspect the insurance paid for the new station. I drew up the design of the new station, and Professor Harding got it approved by the Department of Commerce, Bureau of Navigation. Herbert Hoover was Secretary of Commerce, as this organization was the predecessor to the present FCC. With Ray Bierman as my assistant, we were all paid 75 cents per hour, regardless of duties at the station. We began construction as parts arrived. I worked through the summer, and in the fall I picked up Ray Yoder, Glenn Wiest, and Reed Bruner to
to assist in the construction. When the new school term opened, however, the station was not complete. Sometime that fall, the station was ready, and I must quote to you in its entirety an undated clipping from the Purdue Exponent. J.W. Stafford, faculty member who has charge of the policies of the local radio broadcasting station, said yesterday, WBAA has reached that stage of near completion at which operators can now say without hesitation that the university is on the air. Local and long-distance reports accord the station many favorable words, which compare favorably with those received by many large stations in the Middle West. P.C. Sandretto, chief operator and designer of the transmitter, stated yesterday that every effort will be made to constantly improve the quality of signals that are transmitted, and new pieces of apparatus will continue to be added to the present equipment in order to keep abreast with the rapid change and the improvement in modern broadcasting stations. The Exponent goes on to say, tonight we'll bring to WBAA listeners the following artists at 7 o'clock. Captain O. Pickett and his banjo pickers, H.E. Firestone, xylophonist, Paul Borders, baritone, and Oscar Rosen, staff violinist. Borders' accompanist will be Charles Culbertson. Dr. O.P. Terry, student medical advisor, will give a short educational talk. Ray Bierman is scheduled to take care of the announcing and directing of the programs. Mr. Sandretto goes on to say, I don't know how much fan mail WBAA receives these days, but in those days we had a very enthusiastic audience. The telephone rang constantly with requests for numbers, and we received many letters from fans telling us how wonderful our programs were, even on those occasions when I knew the quality left much to be desired. WBAA changed frequencies on June 29, 1934, shifting to 890 kilocycles with 1,000 watts of power and sharing time with WILL at the University of Illinois. At this time, WBAA was broadcasting about 25 hours a week. The programs included an agriculture forum, a program for homemakers, music, news, dramatic readings, and educational programs covering such topics as physics, biology, literature, and vocational guidance. The many programs represented, of course, the use of many people. We'd like you to meet some of these people. And to introduce our first guest, here is WBAA's farm director, Horace Tyler.
Among the earliest staff members, Extension Service staff members, to broadcast over WBAA back in the early days was M.O. Pence, who at that time was an Extension agronomist. And M.O., I guess you were Extension agronomist here at Purdue for, oh, a good number of years before you finally retired when?
32 years here.
32 years, and you retired when?
In 57.
It only seems like yesterday.
That's right. That's the way it seems to me, Horace.
Well,
very recent.
Back in 1922 and 1925, I guess that was about, 25 was about the first time you made an appearance.
First time I came on, yes. I came here in January 25.
Well, what prompted you to take up broadcasting as an agronomist?
Well, I really can't give you the real background of that, Horace, except that the institution was going ahead with this, and the agriculture department, I think, was about as active as anybody here in going on WBAA. And so we sort of took our turns by departments, I think, at the instance of Tommy Johnson and the Department of Information, and I think he was sort of heading up the broadcasting at that time, as I recall it.
Well, Tommy knew how to stir things up along
well,
the line.
Well, you couldn't turn Tommy down. No, he was too good a fella, you know.
Well, what was the first thing you talked about on the radio?
Well, I think maybe I talked about alfalfa the first time, Horace, and we had it in the old electrical building over here that's now, it has disappeared and replaced by this new modern chemistry building over here on the campus.
I remember that building. It was torn down while I was still an undergraduate college here, I think in about 47 or 48, somewhere along
there. Well, I think it was the first place that they had as a studio, and as I remember, it was on the ground floor there. I know I never walked upstairs, and I don't think I was ever in the building before in my life. And I want to say it was a weird experience to, you'd been used to talking to people. And there you went in and just talked in a little screened affair, you know. And I don't know. I can't describe the experience one has the first time. Probably today it wouldn't be that way because it's such a common medium of communication. But then, of course, it was unique and it was new and it was weird.
Well, did you feel as if you were simply talking into outer space, or did you have some sort of audience visualized?
That was the weird part of it. You just wondered, is anybody listening? How many are listening? And how is this going over? Yes.
What sort of apparatus did you face when you went into the
Well, it was a very small mic, and it looked to me about like a Bunsen burner with a screen on top of it, and that's what we used for the mic.
Well, what kind of broadcasting techniques were used? Did you get some kind of an introduction, or did you?
I think we were introduced, and practically, I think most of us had a script. We had it written out. We didn't have any impromptu or ad lib very much, and we just read a statement or a script on a subject.
Well, what kind of reaction did you get to your early broadcasts?
Well, we didn't get much, as far as I know, but in a little later. Time we got, I got a few anonymous postcards, which kind of thrilled me, you know, until I found out the author of them, and the man in the department was having a little fun with me, you know.
Well, I'd like to hear a little more about this. It turned out to be a kind of a practical joke.
Oh, yes, just a practical, just I was sitting back enjoying me thinking that I had really got a response from the public, you know.
Well, they have to have a little bit of fun as you
oh,
go.
Oh, surely, yeah, that was it.
Well, not too long after the radio station got its start in the old EE building, it was eventually moved into what was known as the new EE building. That's the present structure,
yes,
which now stands on Northwestern.
On Northwestern. It was up, I believe, on the top floor, as I recall it, on the front there, right facing the Northwestern Avenue.
Well, now, by the time you moved up there, you were an old, experienced broadcaster, weren't you, M.O.?
Well, I wouldn't say I was so experienced. I wasn't so... worried, I mean concerned about it, like you would the first time that you appeared before the thing. You had sort of adjusted yourself a little bit, yes.
Did you have any unusually exciting experiences up in
Well,
the
Well, I think probably I had the most unusual experience anybody's ever had over this, I assume, over this radio station. And the man in the electrical engineering building who was running the affair at that time, and I was giving this making this broadcast, and he was just outside, and he came to the door, the glass door there, and he signaled me with a...
Gave you the cutoff
sign. Cutoff sign, yeah. With a, across his neck there, you know. And I ceased broadcasting then, and I went out in the hall, and we looked in the room adjoining there, as a room with a lot of motors and equipment and so forth. And the place was full of a gray smoke that you could... It was like a dense fog. And we opened the door, and it almost knocked you down. Well, he said, well, the motor's burnt out. There'll be no more broadcasting this evening. And I think it was out for about the best part of a week. So I presume maybe I'm one of the few who knocked out WBA for quite a long time.
You really put them off the
air. I didn't know that I had that powerful a broadcast until I appeared there.
M.O., you mentioned it was an evening broadcast. I hadn't remembered that there had been too many agricultural or farm-type shows on in the evening. What was
Well, that's just the
situation?
Way I recall it. Now, that's my recollection of the thing. It was early evening. Now, I might be mistaken, but that's the way I recall it. Now, whether we had those things at that time, but I know all the others over here were in the daytime that I really had made. Well, and since that time.
The Farm Forum has been a noontime show for
as long as
I can remember.
Yes, yes, I think that's right.
You mentioned a little earlier about being uncertain as to whom you were talking to, whether it was outer space or someone that you had in mind. At that time, much of your extension work involved a great deal of travel, and you had to cover a good many of Indiana's highways and byways and an old Model T Ford. Can you think of some experiences along that time that sort of fit in here that give us a picture of the time?
I had a kind of a peculiar experience, not over this station, but over at Evansville Station. And I was being interviewed there. I think it was Al Bishey, a county agent, and we were talking about alfalfa. And we went out to a farm there, and we just walked out into a field. I don't know what the significance was, but when we were there, why, out comes a farmer. And I guess he recognized Al. He said, you fellows were just listening, he said, at your station over there, you fellows were broadcasting, he said, about alfalfa. So it was a kind of a coincidence there. They just immediately after the broadcast went out in the field, there was a fellow he had actually, we found one man who had actually listened in.
He got some bona fide feedback. had a
testimonial there of evidence that somebody was listening, yes.
Well, M.O., it's been fun visiting with you here and recalling some of the very early days in the WBAA's broadcasting, and quite a good deal of it was concerned with farm programming.
Oh, yes, very much so. I think that probably the Ag Department here had the larger end of the deal on that over there at that time, in the early days. I really do.
Well, I'm glad that most of your experiences were pleasant ones on WBA.
I have many happy recollections of the work over and the meeting with you boys here and working in the station. And I hope that these broadcasts have done some good. I'm quite sure, without being boastful, that take it as a whole, the different departments have done a lot of good in their work over the state through the medium of the broadcasting station.
Well, M.O., thank you very much for being with us. M.O. Pence, a retired extension agronomist here at Purdue.
News has always been an important feature of WBAA's program schedule. Here is Professor Frank Hall of the Purdue Department of History, one of WBAA's early newscasters.
WBAA is celebrating its 40th anniversary. It's been my privilege to be associated with the station for some 30 of those 40 years. Years ago, it was a weekly news summary known as Footnotes on the Headlines. The station was then on the top floor of the EE building. There was no air conditioning anywhere on the campus then. It was pretty hot up on that top floor, particularly on a summer night. We were provided with the last word in luxury at that time, a huge cake of ice resting in a wash tub on the floor with an electric fan on the other side to throw a little bit of cool air on the broadcaster. Professor Stafford was director of the station then. I remember one afternoon it was my privilege to share part of my hour with the famous old radio team of Lum and Ebner. They were in town for, I suppose, the Tippecanoe County Fair or something like that. Somebody persuaded them, probably without too much trouble, to come up and give a few minutes to WBAA. Lum said, "We're right proud to be here." Later, we had a series on the air for the school children of the state, and I had the honor then of having as my scriptwriter, Cecilia Zissis, now Dr. Zissis, Associate Dean of Women. Since then, I have been on Tom Johnson's radio committee for some time, and presently, as a member of the board of directors of the Lafayette Symphony, have at least a remote connection with the music memory contest that WBA is helping so.
When did you first come to WBA? What was your first... How'd you get into the station?
I'll never know. I don't remember. Stafford or... I think it was Stafford that arranged for this. Then later, Gilbert Dunbar Williams was director of the station, and he kept the program going. Wasn't Clarence Damon director of this station at one time, too?
He was at one time,
yes. But those were the good old days of radio. We used to put a number of classes on the air, directly from the classroom. On the first floor of the Restation building, many of the rooms were wired for radio, rather crudely, all the wiring and everything right out in the open, subject to some tampering occasionally.
And we can't forget sports when we think of WBAA's broadcast schedule. Professor Homer Allen called the play-by-play of many a game.
I'm glad to reminisce a little bit about the old days of sports announcing on WBAA, and I mean old days. I think it was 1930, sometime during that year, that I had been listening for a couple of years to Harry Clark, who was then announcing the football and basketball games for Purdue. And I stopped in one day at the old studio over in the Electrical Engineering building up on the third floor and talked with Mr. Stafford, who at that time was the director of the station. I told him that if there was ever a time when he needed somebody as an announcer, I would appreciate the chance to take a shot at it because I thought I knew a little bit about sports and I always liked to talk. And to my surprise, within a relatively short time, I got word from Mr. Stafford that Harry Clark, due to his business in Chicago, was not going to have the time to commute to do the games that he had been doing. So here I was, an announcer. sports announcer, right almost before I realized that there was any such thing going on. So, as you can guess, it was pretty much of a hit-or-miss informal thing. But I had a lot of fun at it, and, of course, the old West Side press box in the west side of the stadium was not nearly the same as it is today, but it was roomy enough for two or three of us that were in there on the games. And I recall how President Elliott used to come up in the booth there between the halves of the home football games to kind of get away from the crowd, I think. And invariably, I would ask him to make a few comments to the thousands of listeners, who were probably dozens at that time. And Prexy was always happy to say a few words, and as those of you know who knew President Elliott, he was always able to pick the appropriate thing to say at the right time. And it's one of my pleasant memories, of course, of Dr. Elliott. And even years later, even after he retired and was living in Lafayette here, as we would meet occasionally at different places, he would recall those old broadcast days in the early 30s. Then the basketball booth in the old men's gym, which is now the women's gym, of course, was about a 4x4 box suspended on one edge of the balcony, the running track that ran around that old gym. There was just room in there for the engineer and the announcer. And believe me, it got pretty hot in there sometimes when we had the gym packed and there was a hot game going on. But I, as a matter of fact, I recall in order to see down to our right in the corner, we had to actually get our face right against the front window in order to peek down there when anybody was in that corner with the ball. I did the announcing for probably 6, maybe 7 years. I really don't remember when I stopped, but the reason I stopped, the policymakers of WBAA decided that really, since this was an educational station, that they should use more students as much as they could. And so they decided that one fall that they should use student announcers on their sports programs as well as on the other things. And I recall the last football game of that particular season, it might have been 36 or 37, somewhere in there. We had four boys up in the booth, and I announced before the game that each of those boys would announce one quarter, and the fans then were asked to send in cards indicating which boy they thought had done the best job. And that boy then would be chosen as the future sports announcer for as long as he was in school. So this was my demise as a sports announcer, except for casual experiences since then. But it really was one of the pleasant things of my life as I remember it. I had a lot of fun, and every once in a while, even now, I'll meet some old-timer who remembers some of the things that I said. Now, let me bring out this one more point here, if I may. I do have here a copy of the first noontime sports broadcast, which I did in September of 1935. I started a 12:30 to quarter of one sports broadcast on Monday and Friday. And on Friday, I and whoever I invited up with me would talk about the games that were scheduled for that weekend, particularly in high school. This was aimed at the high schools directly. And then on Monday, we would come back and discuss the games that had been played over the weekend. And we continued this quite a while and had a lot of fun with it. I remember Doxie Moore, who at that time was coaching at West Lafayette High School, spent several sessions with me because he was a good sportsman. Then a little later than that, I had Ed Smith, who was still a student here and who is now a businessman in Fort Wayne. He helped me on it. And we would invite high school principals or high school coaches in, and it worked out pretty well. I think I quit that probably about the time that I quit the other sports, the game, the actual game announcing. Well, these are just a little of the of the what I call pleasant things that I recall and have saved down through the years. I congratulate WBAA on the sports coverage that they have done during the years, and I wish them continued success in all of Purdue's events.
...1941 saw a number of changes in WBAA. In the spring of that year, the station's frequency was changed to the present 920 kilocycles, and the studios were moved to the newly completed Hall of Music. The present transmitter, located south of Lafayette, was constructed in the summer of 1941, and on September 27th, WBAA began broadcasting from the new facilities with a power of 5,000 watts. One of WBAA's educational features, School of the Air, was first presented in its current form on September 11, 1944. Initially, the programs were mainly for high school students and consisted of courses in mechanical drawing, agriculture, and Spanish. At present, School of the Air consists of 15 series aimed at students in grades 1 through 12. Programs now are concerned with such subjects as music, speech, Indiana history, science, and self-understanding. Here once again is Tom Johnston to tell about some early attempts to educate and inform by radio.
By 1937 or 8, we started a poultry class, and Glenn Sample, who is now the first vice president of the Indiana Farm Bureau, he's a Purdue graduate and worked with me for 8 years, was on my staff at Purdue while serving as a member of the information staff at the university. He developed those courses. We sat down and worked it out with the specialists in poultry, and in swine production, we got an actual enrollment of farmers, and we put those lessons on Mondays and Friday nights, hewing to that old plan that we started. We developed quite an audience on these Monday and Friday night programs from year to year.
Now, these were not for credit.
They were not for credit, but the fellows took an examination and sent in their examination papers, and they were graded and returned to them. We carried it through a series of 10 or 12, about a dozen lessons.
It was more or less a self-improvement course.
Self-improvement
no credit, but
it was a step in adult education. Mm-hmm. About 1937 is about when it was, because Sample started with me in 1936, and it was about a year or two after that that we put on these courses. It was before World War II. They're among the first, if not the first, in the United States. It was a new idea in those days, a School of the Air.
Well, we've brought our story up to the present time as far as chronological order goes, but there's one man who qualifies as both an early listener and a performer as host of the popular program Songs of the People. To recap the WBAA story from his own experiences, here is Bob Hildebrand.
Well, my first contact with WBAA was in the winter of 1923, perhaps January or February. I don't remember exactly which it was. But I had a friend who had one of these new boxes called a radio. And this was my third trip up to his home, and every time I went up there, he would seat me and put a pair of headphones on my head, which hurt, incidentally. Being a young boy, 7 years old, I wasn't particularly impressed with headphones in those days. And then we would listen to squeals and squalls and loud crashes, and once we heard some music, the old oaken bucket it was, which he said came from Detroit. And the second time we heard, innumerable stations all coming in at the same time. Of course, we still have that phenomenon today in spite of some of our regulations, but in those days it was much more apparent than it is now. Well, this particular occasion was on a Sunday evening, and he turned his box on and put the headphones on his ears, and then took them off rapidly and put them on my ears and said, "Now you sit here, and pretty soon you're going to hear something from Lafayette, because Purdue University has one of these radio stations." Well, frankly, I didn't care much for radio. The two times before that I'd heard it, I wasn't impressed. And so I sat there and I listened, and I will say that this was louder than anything I had heard to date. There were squeals and there were squalls. And then occasionally, someone would come on and say, "Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, it was understandable, but not particularly educational. So I listened to that for a while, and then there was a silence. And pretty soon he came back over and said, "Well, how are you doing?" And I said, "Just fine." And he said, "What's on?" And I said, "Nothing." And he said, "Oh, there's bound to be," and took the phones off my ears and said, "Well, they've gone off the air." So that was my first contact with WBAA. Might say in those days, George, that we didn't have any Federal Communications Commission or even any Federal Radio Commission, because that didn't come along until several years later. And stations more or less did what they pleased on the air, including the fact that they didn't have any regular schedules. If a person had a license, you got some kind of a license from the government to set up a broadcasting station, and you started in. And whenever you had something that you felt would go, you put it on the air. And when you didn't have anything, you simply went off the air, and that was that. You did something called signing off, which confused me greatly for a number of times that I listened to the radio, because I couldn't understand why it was that they said they were now going to sign off, and after that they kept silent. But that was one of the things that happened. Another interesting thing was stations had a lot of drift in those days. That is, they didn't have crystal control such as they have now, and they started in, and you might find them on one dial number, and pretty soon the station would begin to sort of fade out a little bit, and you'd turn your dial and it would get louder, and you'd listen a little bit longer, and pretty soon it would change again. And it changed quite a bit, particularly in the early days. Well, in 1925, I received one of those little boxes for Christmas. And at that time, the box had improved considerably, enough so that I wanted one then. And I've wanted one ever since and still do. The one I had was powered by batteries. And by that time, WBAA was very definitely WBAA. It had a regular schedule. Every morning from 9:50 to 10 o'clock, there were markets and weather. And then on Monday and on Friday evenings at 7 o'clock, there was a program, usually. They were live. Almost all of them were live. There was very little recorded music on the radio in those days. And almost anybody in this area that could do anything at all, and I don't mean just sing or play a musical instrument, but make a speech or give a dramatic reading or give a reading that wasn't dramatic or even spell. We've had spellers, champion spellers on the air back in the early days. And they would come on with a group of artists, or one artist as the case may be, and during the program someone would call up on the telephone. Sometimes they'd send in wires, but more often they called up on the phone, and it was usually a friend or acquaintance who knew of the person performing and what they could do, and they'd call up and make a request, and then the announcer would come in and say, "Mr. So-and-so or Miss So-and-so, we have a request for you to do such-and-such," and it was usually something that the performer was quite capable and willing and ready to do. And sometimes they'd do an hour, and sometimes they'd do a half an hour. And sometimes they'd get a mic fried and didn't do anything, and then again they wouldn't show up, in which case the station wouldn't come on the air, or it would come on the air and just test the equipment and go off the air. Then there were football games, and there were basketball games, and there were remotes from the Purdue Union ballrooms or other places on the campus where dances were held. And in those days, when they broadcast from a dance, they broadcast the whole thing. They start at 10 o'clock or so and maybe go until 12 or 12:30 or 1 o'clock, whenever the band played "Good Night, Ladies" or "Home Sweet Home" or whatever they ended with. And then the announcer would come on and say, "You've been listening to such and such an orchestra," and they'd sign the station off and go to bed. Another interesting thing was, this happened about 1927. We're skipping years here rather rapidly, but at that time, we had a Federal Radio Commission, which allocated stations to definite wavelengths, and we usually kept to our own wavelength. In fact, WBAA, being an engineering school radio station, did remarkably well on that. But I remember that one Chicago station was broadcasting at that time on 980 kilocycles. And they had a program at 9:30 in the morning from one of the theaters in Chicago. And I listened to the organ music. And during one of the organ selections, I'd hear testing 1, 2, 3, 4. And I knew what was coming. And then once in a while, somebody would say, WBAA, bah. And I knew that time was about to begin. It was almost 9:50 in the morning and time to begin the markets. Now, that station was broadcasting on 1,100 kilocycles. And the Chicago station to which I was listening was broadcasting on 980 kilocycles. So you can see that there was quite a dial spread. And it wasn't just a little inexpensive battery box that I was using, because during that summer, the summer of 1927, my uncle bought a very expensive, very modern new radio, which had something called an eliminator, which eliminated the B batteries. And it was semi-electric. And his expensive radio had the same trouble that mine did. When I listened to the Chicago station on his radio and WBAA came on and tested or read the markets or whatever they did, it would come clear up to 980 kilocycles. So we had quite a dial spread. And every once in a while, someone would get unhappy because, quote, that Purdue station is on tonight and we can't get anything but that, unquote. But it was still fun. We liked to hear our friends. Some of the early contributors to the programs, you might be interested in some of them. There was, for example, the Family Theater Orchestra. One of the theaters in Lafayette at that time was the Family Theater, and it had an orchestra, and that orchestra would go up to the EE building where the station was located and play a program every once in a while. Then also various members of the Purdue staff would contribute. I remember hearing Dean Potter any number of times giving talks on the radio, and other friends of mine, acquaintances, people that I knew who would come on the air and give a talk on their particular field. The football at that time, and I suppose the basketball, although I don't remember too much about the basketball. I was away from home a great deal of the time. At that time I was in boarding school, and I didn't get to hear all the basketball games. But the football games were done by a man named Harry Clark, and he would give the games in a very exciting manner and try to put himself into the whole thing and make it sound as though he were really there, which he was, sometimes almost too much. In those days, you didn't have soundproof booths such as you have now. Have to hang a microphone out the window to pick up the crowd noise. He would sit right in the middle of the crowd, and the noise would come through, sometimes louder than he did. And there is the story, which I have heard, although I didn't hear the broadcast myself. Some of my friends heard it, in which a basketball game was broadcast, one of the very early games, and the announcer, whoever he was at that time, was seated up in the bleachers. And the people were sitting around him, and some of the men who were sitting around there didn't like the way that the referee was calling some of the plays. And they expressed themselves accordingly, and it, even without a commission, it became a little bit, difficult to handle, shall we say. Then I remember the fire, or remember reading about it, because after the great fire, for many months, there was silence on 1,100 kilocycles, or 1,400 as it was at that time, because we'd had the big shift then. Many of the radio stations in the United States had shifted wavelengths, according to Federal Radio Commission ruling, and WBAA had gone from 1,100 kilocycles to 1,400 kilocycles. They shared time then with a station in Indianapolis. And shortly after that came the great fire, and then there was silence for a long time. Finally, an item came out in the paper that Purdue University had again rebuilt its radio station and was going to resume broadcasting. And then you had an almost direct opposite from what we had had before, in that for some strange reason, the modulation or the sound, for those who are not familiar with the technical terminology, the music or the speaking, was almost inaudible at times, even in Lafayette itself. The carrier wave was there, but you could hardly hear the people that were performing. And it made for quite a difficult situation. I remember someone reading to me from the Lafayette paper quite an article trying to explain why it was that you couldn't hear the sound of the performance better on your local radio station, and saying that they would eventually get the station controlled, which they did. That carried on until 1934, when WBAA again shifted wavelengths and went on to 890 kilocycles, increased its power from 500 to 1,000 watts, and shared time with the University of Illinois radio station. And at that time, they had quite a program. For one thing, they began to use phonograph records, as they were called at that time, to a much greater extent than ever before. When the station was on 1400, I believe it was once a month during the winter, they had a frequency check. That was an order of the Federal Communications Commission. Once each month, the station had to check its frequency by doing a broadcast program of some 15 minutes between the hours of 1 and 5, I believe it was, or 4 or 5 in the morning. And two or three times a year, WBAA would decide that they would make a night of it, and they would come on the air after midnight and broadcast until almost sunrise, and they would get telegrams from listeners both near and far. I remember one telegram came from California. Perhaps they'd had many. And they broadcast almost exclusively phonograph records, although occasionally a group, a student group, or a local group would come in and perform live. Until 1934, the station operated almost exclusively on Purdue's time. During academic vacations, the station was not on, particularly during the summer vacation when they went off the air right after commencement in June and didn't resume broadcasting until September. But after changing from 1,400 to 890 kilocycles and going from 500 to 1,000 watts, the station began to have a regularly organized program for 3 whole hours a day, from 12 to 2, and from 4 to 5 in the afternoon. The rest of the time was used by the University of Illinois for their radio station. And I believe it was perhaps 1937, 36 or 37, that the station began to broadcast by special permission from the Federal Communications Commission the night basketball games of Purdue, the home games. And believe me, for those of us who live outside the immediate Lafayette area and who can't go to the Purdue games, this was a real boon. I personally enjoyed those games very, very much, as I still do all of the Purdue games which I hear on WBAA. I think perhaps that was the last big change in station's policy and programming until 1941, when it moved into the Hall of Music and went on the 5,000 watts daytime, 1,000 watt night, and assumed somewhat the present schedule of programming. And let me say before leaving that it's been a pleasure to broadcast over the station. It is going to continue to be a pleasure to broadcast over the station, because believe me, I'm not leaving the air. And it's been a lot of fun broadcasting on this particular occasion, when I could let my hair down, what there is left of it, and really tell some of these things about the early days of radio, which to me, are among the most fascinating things that have occurred during my lifetime. I like to reminisce. I guess that's a sign of old age. But whenever anyone is interested, and I find that more and more people are as time goes on, I do like to tell them about the things that happened in the early days of radio. And I still think that radio is the greatest type of entertainment medium and communications medium that has been developed.
Here is WBAA's manager, John DeCamp.
My own WBAA career began as a student announcer back in the fall of 1940. Since that time, with the exception of 2 years right after my graduation in 1943, I've been constantly associated with WBAA. Working at WBAA has always meant more to me than the word work implies. I've enjoyed all of my duties at the radio station, and I have particularly enjoyed the many contacts I've made with interesting and interested listeners. I think I can speak on behalf of the entire staff in saying that we all appreciate your comments, criticism, and suggestions. Our purpose as one branch of Purdue University is to serve the people of Indiana as well and in as many ways as possible. We hope to be able to carry out this aim for at least 40 more years.
To conclude our special program, we are very pleased to have the president of Purdue University, Dr. Frederick L. Hovday.
I'm truly delighted to have this opportunity to participate in the programs celebrating WBAA's 40th birthday. Since its founding back in the decade of the 20s, when some of us are old enough to remember those first radio receiving sets and the thrill of staying up all night to get KDKA in Pittsburgh or some far-off place, WBAA has offered the state of Indiana a means by which its citizens can be and have been made aware of the tremendous developments that have occurred in science, industry, agriculture, and many other fields of endeavor. Truly, WBAA serves as a statewide extension of Purdue University, and this station has always made available a wealth of knowledge and information to those who otherwise could not benefit from an association, a direct association, with a university center of learning and research. Also, the addition of artistic and cultural avenues offered through WBAA establish a complete picture of the total picture, of the total university. WBAA was the pioneer broadcaster in our state, and it has set an example of service plus quality entertainment with the flexibility of programming and imagination, which has enabled this station to utilize to the fullest extent unique and valuable people living in the university, living and serving in the university environment. From 1922 to the present, with the constant work of dedicated and talented people, WBAA has truly become the voice of Purdue. And I am delighted to add my best wishes and congratulations to this great station and all its members who've served it so well on the occasion of its 40th birthday.
Well, there you have the story about as well as it can be told. The story is told by those who made it, by those who lived it. We wanted you to hear the story because you, the listener, are our purpose for being here. And we invite you to stay tuned for at least another 40 years of service to you
your children, grandchildren, and their children. We'll be here because, as they say, life begins at 40.